I'm in the studio with Dolores Huerta. And when the history of this century is written, there will be two names which will not be forgotten in the history of the whole situation of farm labor in the United States. One of them is Cesar Chavez, and the other is, without question, Dolores Huerta. And she is vice president of the United Farm Workers and the director of contract negotiations. At one time, during the opening stages of the fight between the growers and the farm workers in the valley, and the march to Sacramento and so on, we had almost daily reports on what was happening. But it's been quite a while since either you or Cesar have been able to visit the studio. So why don't you bring us up to date? Where are we now, Dolores?
Well, I guess we're still pretty much involved in trying to end the 1965 Delano strike. There have been, of course, some contracts that have been signed. We had, as you remember, here in San Francisco, it seems that somehow our battle always ends up in San Francisco. But it makes us feel good because we know when we get to San Francisco, we're near the finishing stages of the war. And we did have some terrible battles up here with the Schenley people, the DiGiorgio people, and then finally the Pirelli Minetti. All of those were, of course, we were victorious, primarily due to all of the people in this area that supported our boycotts and that walked the picket lines to get these contracts for farm workers. So that now we do have 8 union contracts that are signed that cover the farm workers with a basic minimum wage of $2 an hour guaranteed. On harvest rates, they average from $3.40 to $5 an hour on a crew average, which means that some farm workers are making as much as $6 an hour for wine grape picking. We do have a medical plan now for farm workers that covers maternity benefits, prescription costs, and first doctor visits. It's the first one of its kind in the country, a very unique plan at Caesar, working with an insurance consultant firm here, Mr. Burkhoff, were able to work out. It's a very beautiful plan because it covers the worker that only works 100 hours out of the year. So we know that we have made some progress. We have close to 3,000 workers now covered under union contracts. We had one very big setback when the DiGiorgio Corporation sold their ranch. That happened the first part of this year. And arbitrator Sam Cagle did not see fit to give us a successor clause when he arbitrated the DiGiorgio contract, so that we lost that contract, which was our largest contract, which
was it broken up into smaller holdings, or was it sold outright?
Actually, the ranch in Delano was broken up into smaller holdings, and it was sold to about 20 different people. The ranch in Arvin, however, was just sold to two large employers, Milan Caratan, who is one of the struck growers in Delano, and S.A. Camp, who was a very large landowner who holds about 26,000 acres of land and now has the additional DiGiorgio land. So we, of course, are striking Mr. Camp, but we're not having too much effect. That was a tremendous fight that we had to try to get that ranch under a union contract, and we're having a difficult time in trying to get the new owner to sign a contract with the union, even though heavens knows in this case there's no question of representation because we did have an election, which we won, and we did have an agreement. It's tragic that Mr. Cagle, treated our union in the fashion that he did. I think that he might have foreseen or that we were not going to succeed in some way, because we do have successor clauses in every one of our other contracts that we've got signed now.
How does it happen that there was no successor clause in the Georgia contract?
Well, that was part of the contract that went into arbitration. We negotiated half of the contract, and parts of the contract went into arbitration. The wages, the medical plan, et cetera, went into arbitration. The successor clause was one point at which we couldn't agree upon. And the successor said that if anyone bought the ranch, then they would have to take the union as part of buying the ranch, and that was not in the contract. So therefore, when DiGiorgio did sell, then we were left out in the cold. And now that's just been added on to the bigger fight.
And because you haven't got the legal right to organize as other workers organize, this means that you have to deal with every individual landowner in organizing the farm workers. Isn't that correct?
Well, that would, I think, normally be true. I think that the we've sort of broken away from that. At the time when we tried to get an election with the Jamara Corporation and they refused, we subsequently put a boycott into effect against one grower, the Jamara Corporation. This is the largest landowner in the United States. He has 12,000 acres of grapes. When we couldn't, then we could, our boycott wasn't effective against the Jamara Corporation because they started changing labels. So then what we decided the best thing to do would be to try, we approached the rest of the grape growers in the state of California, up in the Fresno area and up in the Lodi area, asking them for representation elections. They refused to answer our letters. So then we instituted the strike and the boycott against all of the grape industry. So at the present time, we're not singling out any one individual employer. Right now, our total boycott is focused upon the entire grape industry. And, of course, it's
a consumer boycott.
Right. That means really an escalation in terms of you know, our battle. But it means that it's going to take us a lot longer. But hopefully, when it's over, we'll have
the
whole
industry.
How's
it working out? Do you have any idea how effective it is?
It's been extremely effective. The growers themselves, and we can go by their figures, are suing the union at the present time for $75 million. That they claim that we have cost them in grape sales. We know our own research indicates that they have sold this year less than 50% of their crop and that their sales have dropped from 30 to 40%, and in some cities like New York City, 50% from what they normally would be. We know that they've taken a tremendous beating on the price. The one mainstay that seems to be holding them up, at least on the West Coast, seems to be this whole Safeway stores. Safeway almost has, you know, well, it has about 16% of all of the grocery market produce in the West Coast, and I think in the San Francisco Bay Area, it's probably much more than that. You have very few independent chains or small independent stores, so that Safeway sort of has a monopoly, and Safeway has consistently refused to take the grapes off. I think that's understandable in one respect, because Safeway does have a direct tie-in with the agribusiness interests. The boards of directors of Safeway stores control about 1 million acres of land. And the boards of directors of Safeway, such as J.G. Boswell and Arbuckle, received $6 million in government subsidies for not growing things, see. So they have a very direct and they're a very tied in interest. We had a petition drive where we, a million signatures were sent to Safeway stores asking them to remove the grapes from their shelves. And even in spite of all of this evidence, picket lines, I think every Safeway store in California and certainly in Colorado and Arizona have been picketed. And in spite of this, Safeway has just held very strong and has refused to take the grapes off.
Tell me, Dolores, what about the people? When I remember Delano, you had large numbers of people in Delano itself who were picketing growers and so on. Mm-hmm. And who had in one way or another to be supported and taken care of. Mm-hmm. Have most of those people in some way or another been absorbed and the concentration is on the boycott, or are they sent out to participate in the picketing, boycotting the retail stores and other places? What's happening
right.
to the people in Delano?
Well, most of the people in Delano most of the strikers are out on the boycott. We have farm workers in 60 cities throughout the United States, and we have them in 4 provinces in Canada. And they are organizing and asking people to help picketing, et cetera, on the boycott. So there's really very few people in Delano. We did have a picket line, and we still have a picket line in Delano of some of the people that, for some reason or the other, because of personal problems or health problems, can't go out on the boycott. But we have tried to put most of our concentration has been on the boycott. Some of the farm workers that have been out haven't been home for 2 years now. You know, they've been out on the boycott for 2 years now. And they've made, a tremendous amount of sacrifices. Delano doesn't quite look the way it used to before. We now have our co-op, a gasoline station that was built. We have our building, which the auto workers, you know, donated money to have this building built for our new headquarters that will be opening on the 1st of November. And so it's growing all of the time, you know. The Delano community itself is enlarging all of the time. And we still have, of course, volunteers that will come down there and help us, and doctors that come down there and donate their time, et cetera. So it's the community feeling, is still very strong there, and the movement feeling is still very strong. People still don't get paid in Delano. They get $5 a week and, you know, whatever groceries can be brought to them.
And you're largely dependent still then on the contributions from the public to keep all of this going.
Yeah, very,
nationwide.
Very definitely. A lot of people say, well, gee, was the strike's been going on so long? I guess certainly the farm workers feel this way more than anybody else does, because but we don't get faint-hearted, or we don't, you know, we don't even. I think no one in the strike even gives a second thought of giving up. You know, we know that we can win if we just stick with it. We know that we're going to overcome. Sometimes our liberal friends say, "Well, gee whiz, why don't they do something?" You know, we did have a chance to sign a contract with the growers. We had negotiations with 11 of the table grape growers in the Delano Coachella area. And some of our liberal friends say, "Well, why didn't you sign that contract? It's a foot in the door is more important." Well, the reason that we didn't sign the contract is because the growers refused to put any protective language on the issue of poisons. And our research has shown us that many thousands of farm workers, and these are Food and Drug Administration figures, by the way, that close to 1,000 farm workers are being killed by the poisons that are put on the crops, and between 80 and 90,000 are being injured. So the growers wanted us to agree that if we did get a contract, that we would never raise the issue of poisons again against any segment of the industry. Well, we're not, you know, in the business of just getting members and just collecting dues. We are in trying to change the conditions for farm workers and trying to improve the situation. So we weren't about to sign a contract like that.
They wanted you to put it in the contract that you would not talk about the influence of pesticides or the poisoning of the crops.
Right.
In return for getting a contract.
Right. And it's even, you know, we've been working on the pesticide problem now for a couple of years. See, farm workers sort of took poisoning as a working condition, you know, the same way that they took a lack of a toilet or the lack of hand washing facilities or, you know, the bad treatment that you get. This was just an occupational you might say an ordinary thing. Well, now that we're asking the farm workers to come forth, it's just amazing what we found out. First of all, the Department of Public Health here in Berkeley with the University of California did a survey in Tulare County, and they found that of 774 farm workers that were tested, 80% of them had injuries from pesticides, and most of these were grape pickers, people that worked in the grapes. In Tulare County, the Salud Clinic did a test on the blood of children of farm workers, and they found that 37%, this is like epidemic proportions, you know, 37% of the children had twice the normal amount of DDT in their bloodstreams. Well, you know, there's been all kinds of evidence linking the DDT to cancer, and it's almost like dooming those children before they even have a chance to do anything. You know, it's just like saying, well, all kinds of things are going to be happening to them in later life. And heaven knows by the time they get to be adults, that dosage that they have in their systems will be much greater than that, because DDT does store in the fatty tissues of the body. We're making a very big point of this now, and we're trying to get this point across, because many consumers that really don't give a damn about farm workers, because unfortunately we do in our country have a few people like that that say, well, you know, why don't they get out of the situation? Well, we're hoping that maybe some of them will care a little bit about what's happening to their own bodies, because we took 20 samplings of grapes here in the Bay Area. Every single sampling had DDT and DDE and some other poisons. One Safeway sampling had hexachlorophene, which is a pesticide that is outlawed. There's no tolerance for it at all. A Calistor, the one on California and Hyde, we tested the grape, their grape, and it had parathion on it. And every single grape that was tested had poison on them. Now, the Food and Drug Administration people have got a petition that it's been filed with the Health and Welfare asking for the tolerance level on DDT to be brought down to zero. And we met with them, and we asked them why, you know, how it was that they could ban the cyclamates in the soft drinks, you know, because they cause cancer in mice. And while DDT has been found to cause cancer in mice, why can't they ban food with DDT in it, or ban the use of DDT in foods? And their answer, this is the regional director in San Francisco, his answer was, well, one, the cyclamates come under the food additive law, and the DDT comes under the pesticide law. So it's quite obvious, I think, that the Food and Drug Administration and the state, the Department of Agriculture, the Federal Department of Agriculture, and the growers are very tied into a very tight, neat little conspiracy. And we're not going to get very much action out of them, I think, in terms of doing anything on the pesticide issue, so we have to again depend on the people. You know,
well, there's a great deal more public interest than there was. in the whole issue of the use of pesticides and in general the pollution of food and air and so on. The volume of public concern on that issue and the number of people who speak about it and the number of conferences there are about it has, I would think, well, I'm sure that it's trebled in the last year. So there is a growing public awareness of the problem.
One of the things that I fear personally is that when people do become alarmed about something, then they're hoping that some kind of a law will be passed, you know, that will take care of the problem. And many people believe that when a law is passed, somehow, you know, there's going to be enforcement of that law. Well, one of the things that we have found out very drastically and clearly is that laws are not enforced for the poor. I'm sure that if a law were passed tomorrow that DDT should be banned, that, well, in fact, they did ban the use of DDT in many 50 crops, but they left out grapes and cotton, which are the biggest, you know, crops in which DDT is used in California. But even if there were a law passed tomorrow, the growers would continue doing as they always have done. As now you have, you know, you have these laws, one law that says there shall be toilets in the fields. There aren't any toilets in the fields. You know, there's, we have hundreds of affidavits. Anybody that goes to where farm workers are working will see that there aren't any toilets. There shan't be children working in the fields. Well, children are working every single day in the fields. They have the other laws about the minimum wage, you know, the $1.60 an hour minimum wage for women and minors. That law is violated every day in the fields. And the growers, as long as they have the total political control of their communities, as they now have, are not going to bother to enforce any laws. This is why the whole question of a union contract and of an organization of a union becomes so important. Because unless we have a union contract, then we don't have enforcement. When we do have a union contract, then the union steward then becomes the enforcement officer of that particular, whether it be a toilet or whether it be, as we have in the Pearl Menetti contract, protective language for workers so that they won't be killed on their job by poisons.
What are the growers doing for labor at the moment? Or are people who are in the union working in the fields now?
Well,
what about the places where there is no contract? Are they still running in labor, foreign labor?
Right, right. They're continuing their practice of bringing people in from Mexico. Some union members, of course, have gone to work. We've been able to put people to work at Shenley, and we put people to work at Pearl Menetti. And so, you know, we were able to get some of these strikers back to work. And some, of course, of the members do have to work until they're found out, you know, because as soon as they find out that there's a union member working, he's fired. But they depend very, very much on people that they bring in from Mexico.
Well, how are they managing that? Is it the usual illegal passage over the border? Is
right.
That it?
Right. There isn't any effort at enforcement made and any willingness to enforce even that law that the people from Mexico could not come in behind and work behind a picket line. During the strike in Coachella, which we had in June, you know, Coachella's only 2 hours away from the Mexican border. You can go down there and watch the fellows come over to work, you know. Senator Mondale went down there, and he saw the people coming across to work. And they just go right back to Mexico in the evening. Of course, when they come up to the Delano area, they stay in the growers' camps. And we still have the problem. We can't get into the camps because if we do, we're trespassing. We can't get in to talk to the workers. They have an unlimited supply of labor from Mexico. That's not their problem.
Well, what is the national government and the immigration authority? What are they doing, if anything? Every so often, it seems to me there's a committee of some kind that comes and takes testimony and so on. Do the farm workers still have some hope of national legislation which would make farm workers eligible for the same rights to organize and so on that the rest of American labor is eligible for?
Well, there's a big furor and cry now for legislation, and the growers are the ones that are asking for it. And they're asking for the kind of legislation that would take away our right to strike and make compulsory arbitration and, you know, just try to control the union and make our contracts as weak as possible. We would welcome legislation. However, the kind of legislation that we think that we need to organize farm workers is the same kind of legislation that labor had during its organizing era, which was from 1933 to 1948, before the Taft-Hartley amendments to the law were made. Because the Taft-Hartley amendments forbid boycotts. And most of labor was organized, you know, through boycotts and sympathy strikes and hot cargo strikes, etc. Well, maybe a large segment of labor doesn't need those strengths anymore. We do, because the farm workers are very powerless economically, socially, and politically. We need the boycott to be able to organize. It's been very interesting in looking at the labor movement in recent years to note that in the South, where the Amalgamated Clothing Workers and the textile workers are trying to organize, they've had a very, very hard time organizing in the South. Because, as you know, the National Labor Relations Law gives you a right to an election. This is all that it does. And then it says that the employer has to bargain in good faith if the union wins the secret ballot election. But what's happening in the South is that these unions are winning elections, but they never get any contracts, because the employers just stall them and stall them and stall them. The J.P. Stevens Corporation is a very good example of that, where they have consistently fought unionization, although the unions have had the elections, but they haven't been able to get contracts. So right now, the National Labor Relations Board is really hampering organization of unions in areas where the employers have strong political control, such as in the South, or as they would, I think, in California. The only unions that are really organizing and making a big push in the South are those that are like us, that are not covered under the law, like the state, county, municipal employees, workers, you know, the people that had the sanitation strike in Memphis where Dr. King was killed, you know. These unions are making a big push, and they are organizing. Public employees who are not covered under the law are being able to organize much, much better at this time than those that are covered by the law.
In other words, unless the NLRB law is changed, you feel that its application to the farm workers would be detrimental rather than helpful.
Oh, very definitely. Very definitely it would be. Yes, because we know that we have the strength to organize and the power to, or not power, the willingness to organize. You know, we'll go out and we'll get the support that we need to eventually win. And we're interested, of course, in eventually getting contracts that have a tremendous amount of protection for the workers, because they have such a long way to go, you know, to just be treated like human beings.
Well, now, you said something earlier on, Dolores, which I want to be clear about, that under the contractual arrangements that you have in some cases now, that a worker can earn up to $6 an hour, that is still seasonal labor.
Right.
I think it would be, I'm not sure that
it
you're
might be misleading.
The correct
sure, right,
impression
right.
in the mind of the audience on the basis of what you want to say.
Right. Another reason, I guess I should say, that we have to concentrate on the table grape industry. First of all, the strike originally started there, but our wine grape contracts are highly seasonal. The person working under our Shenley contract or Pirelli Minetti or Almaden or any of these only works maybe 4.5 to 5 months out of the year. An example is that, like Shenley, their peak employment is 400, you know, for 2 months in the picking. Then that drops down to about 275 or 200 during the pruning, see? And all year round, the Shenley Ranch only employs about 20 people. So it's kind of misleading, as you said. And these rates that I'm talking about, where they do earn up to $5 and $6 an hour, those are only on harvest and piece rates. They wouldn't earn that on any kind of an hourly rate. On an hourly rate, they have just a $2 an hour minimum.
Well, in the long term of this situation, because one must believe that we will come to the place in our society sooner or later where all citizens are allowed to earn a civilized living and send their children to school and have proper health services and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
What planning, what ideas, because I know that you and Cesar both think of this in the terms of the community and in much wider terms than simply a wage scale. What could be done about the seasonal aspects of this situation? What kinds of things could be used as supplementary, for example, to the income? How could it be worked out in a long term way? Because people don't even want to be idle 8 months a year.
Right. Well, one of the things, of course, that would do a lot to end the migrancy would be just outright planting. You know, if the grower in the next county, his crop starts shortly after the grape harvest ends, well, then you provide the work so the employee doesn't have to look for it. One interesting aspect of this was at the DiGiorgio Ranch. When we first signed the contract there, DiGiorgio would go thousands of miles into the interior of Mexico to bring workers up to work. But they wouldn't put a bus from Delano to Arvin, which is only 30 miles, so that the farm workers from Arvin, when they finished the grape picking, could go and do some other type of work. This is part of their mentality. They want to have as many workers as possible so that they can get off paying them cheaply. But I think one of the biggest things will be just to provide, information and planning on employment. So you say to the employer, we do have the hiring hall. Okay, instead of starting this week, start next week so that we can continue the employment of the same workers. And that, see, the migrancy of the farm workers is really a forced migrancy. Farm workers in some areas work even longer than cannery workers do, you know, or as many days as construction workers do. But it's really a forced migrancy because they don't have any job protection, and they are, constantly fired, or they have these speed-ups where if they don't work as fast as the employer wants them to, then the whole crews are laid off. So this instability that farm workers face is really caused by the employer. One of the biggest things that we've had to face in our union contracts is trying to get the employers not to mass discharge people, you know, not to fire a whole crew at once. They think they can still do that. They find out very soon that they can't do that. Another thing is that as the farm workers get organized and the head of the family is able to make more money, well, then he can plan a little bit better, see? Now, the farmer pays for his entire ranch operation out of the harvest. Well, the farm worker should be able to do that at least for part of the time. So I think that those problems of seasonality will eventually work themselves out as the workers do become organized.
What else would you like to talk to us about in reference to this situation?
Well, I think that one thing I just think is important, because I think somehow in terms of talking about trying to form the union, and people that aren't aware of labor relations don't realize why unions are important, in that if we do form a union, we are going to have a political force in the valleys of California and on the coast. And that's one of the main reasons why the growers have formed this $2 million war chest, you know, that they've gotten this firm, Whitaker and Baxter, that is doing all of this publicity to try to destroy us, because they don't want a liberal force. I think that the whole issue of pesticides that the union has taken on is an important one, because here we're taking on a basic issue that's not important. It's important not only to the farm worker, but to the consumer and also to the environment. And this is, I think, the union, we're certainly trying to make our union to be, to have a conscience, a social conscience that is larger than just the question of bread and butter. We, of course, have formed our credit union in Delano, where farm workers have, you know, borrowed over $250,000 of their own money. And the farm workers, the directors of the credit union, we have formed our co-op. We now have in Delano Huelga Gas, which sells cheaper than any other gas in town, and that is run by a farm worker. Our whole medical program that we have
is there a grocery program. Co-op?
We haven't started our grocery co-op yet. Right now, we're just having the car and the tires and the parts. And of course, this to farm workers invaluable, because they have to drive out so far to their work. But we are setting up an auto part. We did set up an auto parts store, and we want to get into the whole appliance co-op as soon as we can. So we're certainly trying to move in this direction also. And I think the thing about Delano is that to us, human values are very important, and that farm workers should not only earn more money, but also grow as individuals, you know. I think that's one of the big important things of Delano, why it's important that it should continue and hopefully win. But I think I have to also appeal to everyone in the audience to remember that it isn't enough just to support us or just to hope that we win. We really need pickets. We need people to get out and help us pass leaflets. And this is where we really need the help. And if we don't have this, then our struggle is going to be prolonged. I guess what we're saying is that we want everybody to join the huelga, to join the boycott, and to help us. Because our strike is not going to be one in Delano. It's going to be one in San Francisco, in Los Angeles.
And New York.
And New York, yes.
Thank you very much, Dolores Huerta, for coming in.
Thank you for having me.